Welcome to the Team EF Coaching Performance Podcast, where we take information from the highest level of sport and make it accessible for all cyclists. I'm your host, Zach Morris, and in this episode, I'm sitting down with the podiatrist from EF Pro Cycling, Mr. Mick Habgood. How you doing today, Mick?
It's good to be on here, mate. Good to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you as well. On video this time, I'm looking forward to connecting again in Girona, hopefully at the next team camp. For all the listeners, that's where Mick and I met this year. I was completely fascinated by Mick's process building some really interesting looking custom insoles and completely custom, full custom shoes, time trial shoes, and some really, really, really interesting stuff. So we'll get into all of that stuff a little bit later on in the show. Mick, if you wouldn't mind, one of the things I really like to do for the listeners is just to get a little bit of a background right off the bat from all of the guests. So everybody has an idea of who Mick is and where you come from and how you ended up where you are today.
Well, I'm an Aussie I'm kind of a long way from home now, but so I graduated in podiatry back in like 2005, and actually I did a sports science degree before that, and found myself wondering what I was going to do, and I ended up working with a football team that had a podiatrist doing some pretty cool stuff, and I thought that was a really interesting avenue to go down. I always saw myself as being a physio. And when I saw the things that he was doing, I thought, you know what, this is a super interesting career and I could see myself going down it. If I was going to invest another 4 years at uni, I thought, you know, let's do something a little bit different. And I've been lucky to work in sports medicine essentially ever since. And decided to work specifically though in cycling in about 2013. And that's just because I thought it was time to specialise in something a little bit different. And I had a lot of background in skiing, and the biomechanics of skiing and cycling are super similar. So when I first got to the UK, I started working for one of the biggest ski retailers that had randomly a sports medicine clinic in it. So I was really fortunate to be doing all the stuff, the difficult foot cases with all the ski boot clients. And then from that, I learned how to work with a foot within a static environment, which is what we have in cycling, within the rigid shoes. And that's where I started to kind of figure out that process. And it took me about 3 or 4 seasons to really find my groove with that, ski seasons. And then I realized there was much more cycling going on than there was skiing in the UK at the time. And obviously it's much easier. And I've been fortunate to kind of work in an incredible environment in the cycling shop that I've got in London in CycleFit. And that's basically where the cycling stuff happened. As far as EF goes, well, the pandemic was a bit of a funny one because that was essentially closing many doors. But the pandemic gave me an opportunity to make this shoe that you mentioned, this carbon fiber shoe. And it was something that I always wanted to do because it was something I'd seen from working with Team GB for a number of years, that the shoe they'd been using. And I thought, well, you know, I'm already making the orthotics. I think I can make the next version, which is the upper of the carbon orthotic I was already making. And I used the pandemic to essentially start that project. So when I came back, I just happened to have the owner of EF as one of my clients. And I showed him the prototype and he was super interested. And he thought, you know what, we could use this for Stefan Bissiger and Project Yellow, as they called it. And I met JV, we had a good chat. They were interested. So that was my in. That was my introduction to EF Pro Cycling. And I'm in my second season with them now. And it's an absolute joy working for a team like that. Like I do work a lot in track, but it's about brute power, brute force. It's just kind of like fitting the shoe a bit like a ski boot, but in the road it's different. You know, these guys are doing lots of Ks. It's not just about power, it's more stability, getting them right on the bike. And it's a great setup. So it's been a lot of fun working with them, and I'm really enjoying it.
That's a fascinating pathway that you took from sports science to making one day custom insoles for Project Yellow. That's pretty exciting. So what I love to do on this podcast is talk to experts like you from different areas and just try to give our listeners some really awesome takeaways, help them understand some more things about themselves. So you mentioned something there that the foot is in a static environment in a cycling shoe. Can you maybe tell us why cycling might be different from other sports from a podiatrist perspective?
Yeah, for sure. So look, the feet we all have today are the feet we were born with plus what we've done to it over time, right? So basically what we're doing is we're going into the cycling environment is within a fixed boot. So what happens when we walk and run is that our foot actually moves through itself. So the whole goal of podiatry and biomechanical podiatry and analysis is to encourage the foot to move through itself. So you're trying to encourage sagittal plane movement. Now, in cycling, you're trying to do the opposite. Okay, now why are you trying to do the opposite? Because if your foot is moving, then essentially what you're creating is instability. So the whole kind of goal is actually to stop your foot from moving. But you've got to think about the fact that you're putting you're putting your everyday biomechanics of walking and you're putting that foot type onto a bike. So all the product of how you walk 10,000 steps every day, all the injuries you've had and all that, all have a factor of how your feet function. But what's actually happening within that static environment, that rigid shoe, is that your foot's actually going from side to side. It's not actually going through itself. So you can't really apply walking biomechanics to cycling. So if you do, sure, like, you know, probably go through it, but anything you probably put in your cycling shoes might have a difference and it might play a role in making it feel a bit more comfortable, but you probably won't achieve the goal that you intended because you're not really stopping the movement. And walking and running orthotics are designed to encourage movement. Cycling ones, well, they're designed to do the exact opposite. They're trying to basically make the whole foot work together as one and basically stop that moving.
So let me see if I've got this right. So when you walk, you're walking forward through the foot, as you said. In cycling, even though it's your leg and your foot is moving in the same motion, the movement we're experiencing is a side-to-side movement?
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to minimize, correct?
Yes, because everything we do in cycling is about the sagittal plane. Okay, so the sagittal plane is the plane where we're going directly through the body. So just imagine the notion of how your foot and ankle and knee rotate in a natural cycling revolution. That's the sagittal plane. Now, the more our foot rotates within the other two planes, the frontal and transverse, is when we start to lose power. We start to have movement in planes which don't really give us an advantage in cycling. So what we're trying to do is to literally only control the foot in that plane and minimize the movement in the other two. Now, if we're a robot, it'd be super easy because we're mechanical structures that are built by limitations, but our bodies are elastic. And when they're elastic, they have natural ability to do whatever they want and find compensations. The one thing we know about the feet is that the feet will always find the path of least resistance. And that basically is in life. So basically, most people will have a deviated foot type or pronation to a degree. And that reflects quite a lot of how your big toe joint, the first MPJ, how that joint functions in cycling, because that's a power joint. Now, if you don't engage the power joint, you're probably going to be engaging the fifth. Now, the fifth is the small bone. And most people, from experience, are going to engage the fifth. Now, if you're engaging the little toe, it suggests that basically we're not going to engage the strongest joint, the joint that's most likely to give you the power. That's why it's so big. So we have to try and shift that pressure across to the big toe joint.
Fascinating. I find that when I look at my insoles, I always see the big toe is like massively worn out. It sounds like that's a good thing. I never thought about it being a good thing before.
Well, it's funny because people start looking at their feet so much more after they see them. You know, it's kind of a weird one, but it depends where that pressure is. Now, if it's at the bottom of the toe, that's one thing. If it's under the ball of the foot, that's another. Now, if you've only got pressure at the ball of the under the toe itself, the big toe joint, it's very likely you're actually cramping or crushing the big toe and actually elevating your big toe joint off the ground. And the joint is the power joint, not the toe.
Okay.
So our goal is to actually encourage that big toe joint to actually work. And that's the whole goal, because we're trying to engage the joint that was designed to take the pressure, and most people deviate around that. So my job is to go look at all these different athletes and then basically identify which ones of these are doing that, and then basically put something in their shoes that represents that biomechanical analysis or feedback of that particular rider. And I've got a couple of guys that I can probably reference in the EFT that have like literally baby skin under the ball of the big toe, baby skin, absolute fresh, beautiful skin. And then when you look it under the big toe itself and the fifth, it's like hard, hard, hard callus. And that's really a perfect sign you're not engaging the first MPJ. So that's basically that individual is losing power as a result.
How much power are we talking about?
Well, I mean, it's so I've been able to, you know, been part of some studies that, you know, we've been able to do in-house at, you know, at Olympic team level. And from that, we found that two of the two Olympians that I've worked with have both got 11 and 13% more power when they're using their orthotics. Now, there's a lot of variables that can come into play here. Okay.
11 and 13%.
Yes. So two individuals got that much more. Now, I wasn't at the study. I was just receiving the phone call when they said, Mick, how many percentages do you think the person got with yada, yada, yada? And I had no reference for that at the time. And they couldn't believe it. They did the test three times over for each athlete, and they gave the response, and it was consistent when they didn't have anything in their shoes versus using the orthotics in a Bont track cycling shoe. So, you know, it's a huge output.
That's on the extreme side. Like, that is insane.
It's extreme. 11
to 30, like, that's wild. But what would you say, like,
think about it, yeah.
I mean, at 1,000 watts in a sprint, let's say, which would be a very small amount for a cyclist, we're talking like over 100 watts difference, right?
Well, those guys were punching out almost 2,000 watts. So, you know, you plus 250-odd onto that and getting a lot more power. So, look, I can't unfortunately just go, look, I'm going to do that for everybody. You know, to get that type of individual that's going to get that type of output, they need to have the ingredients. Now, the ingredients are pretty simple, right? Now, the ingredients aren't something that you can choose to have. It's purely based on the biomechanical structures and luck that your family has given you. So why is that? Well, if we think about our frames, we think about our wheels, we think about our shoes, the stiffer everything is, the more power transfer we get, right? It just happened to be that these two particular individuals, now it's not just two individuals I've luckily seen, it's two of a very long list of Olympic riders that, you know, you don't see this very often. So when you have the ingredients of an incredibly stiff body, and a stiff body that a foot is like a plank of wood, there's no other way you can describe it apart from that thing is not going to move no matter what I do. And if I do move the foot, the whole body moves because it's the body's that stiff. Now, when you have a foot that's deviated and you're not engaging the big toe joint and it's deviated in a stiff, stiff environment, if you engage that foot in the right position, that foot naturally is like that stiff frame, like that stiff shoe. So it just aids in that natural ability of that individual to engage the power joint. But if the power joint, being the big toe joint, is what drives the pressure, the whole goal is to – the foot's always going to find the big toe joint when you're cycling. So – the more you can engage the big toe and the faster you can engage it against the pedal, then the more power that person creates and it achieves it faster. Because you've got to imagine there's every downstroke, there's also a pull-up with every revolution. So it's arguable that most people aren't really engaging their big toe joint when they want it before the pull-up occurs. So my goal in track cycling is pretty simple. It's to get the foot in its absolute best position. So when you do that, it locks the foot naturally. And when the foot's naturally locked, what are you going to find? If that individual doesn't have to find the ground finds you. And then when you do that, milliseconds count. It's all about marginal gains. So, you know, we literally are locking the foot. And when you do that, you're creating more power through their biomechanics. So, yeah, it's about, you know, I've got a pretty neutral foot. And we didn't get a chance to see you and give you an assessment at camp, but
it's probably not great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've got a very neutral foot for whatever reason. I've got a very neutral foot and my foot is already pretty much in its best position. Like, I'm not saying it's in the best position, but it's not far off. It just happens to be one of that probably 20% of feet that kind of sit in a relatively neutral range. And as a response to that, then for me, I don't get those power gains because I'm connecting. The big toe connects when it wants to connect. So that's where it becomes a bit of a shame, because I'd love to be able to give those, but those numbers are based on a very unique individual's biomechanics.
Right.
You know, if we look at really hypermobile populations, typically Asian populations, we probably won't see that sort of like stiffness. Rather, you'll get more of a flexibility rather, like a hypermobility. And the problem with the hypermobility is that you're probably going to rotate within the shoe and then potentially lose power or rather not gain as much as that plank of wood because your foot's going to rotate within the shoe. So that's just pure luck or bad luck if that's the case. So that's kind of a bit of a shame. I can't do it to everyone, but it's interesting.
Fascinating. So takeaways there, if you've got calluses on your baby toe, then you're not using the power joint. And if
it doesn't always work that way, but yeah, essentially if it does happen, like you don't always get it, you know, the worst biomechanics in the world, and they can have perfect skin under the balls of your feet. But when you do get a textbook case, it's kind of like, right, clearly it's just really easy for me to show the client. And, you know, when we're together, I can show you the photos, cause I have to take photos of all the athletes, you know, of their feet. And reality is that you can really clearly see it. And it's really easy to show the athlete, this is what you're doing, or rather, this is what you're not doing. So let's engage it and do it.
Fascinating. And if you're wearing your insole down for the most part underneath the joint of the big toe, you're activating the power joint. So calluses
on the
baby toe are bad. Worn insole on the joint of the big toe are a good thing. That's great. So Mick, give the listeners a little bit more of an idea of how they can assess their own foot to understand maybe if they're activating the power joint or not. Or is it as simple as that as I just described?
I mean, it's probably, there's a lot of things you can find on the internet, to be honest. I mean, you can do these pressure pads, or you can wet your feet and hop on a towel or something that gives you an imprint of your foot, right? There's many ways of doing it. It doesn't really indicate whether or not you're going to be activating the big toe joint. That kind of comes down to finding essentially where your talus, which essentially is the bone that connects your lower leg to your foot, when that's in a nice neutral position, which you can kind of feel the heads of it, when that's in a nice neutral position, you look at where your foot is. So, you know, at the end of the day, from my experience, this doesn't count for any studies, but from my experience, probably close to 3/4 of people have a deviated foot type where they're not really engaging the first MPJ as much as we think. Okay. And there are variations of that. There's extremes, there's neutrals, there's the other aspect of like crazy high arches. But the key takeaway is that you could have, it doesn't matter what your foot looks like. Mm-hmm. It's how much it moves, and you can have the world's highest arch and your foot pronates, you know, so it doesn't really, those high arch kind of, you know, the pictures you see, the graphs, it is really hard to kind of look at that and then give a definitive answer, because typically it's a high arch rolls out and a flat foot rolls in, but you can have a flat foot that is completely neutral. You can have a high arch that pronates. So there are definitely, it's not as easy.
Right. So I have personally background. I'm a pronator. So I went on a massive insole hunt a couple of years ago. I went to the podiatrist here. I went to two different podiatrists, had two different fully custom insoles made. One was like really old school, really built up. Probably the worst insole I've ever used in a cycling shoe, I'm not gonna lie. And then I got another more lower profile one that I had some custom molds made, and that one didn't feel good at all. I felt like I had no space in my cycling shoe, just too much volume. And then I went and I picked up a set of Solstar insoles, which were like $150 insoles, and it definitely doesn't stop my pronation, but it feels better than the more expensive ones and more complicated ones that I got. Why might that be?
So Solstar are they're in the line of a generic insole, and they have not a one size fits all approach, but it's a generic insole. So essentially it does have a one size fits all approach. And what they do have is a lateral column of carbon fiber or hard material, I think it's carbon, that goes under the fifth, and then nothing under the fifth toe and the fifth MPJ, and then nothing under the first. Mm-hmm. So what it's doing is it's doing a similar principle. It's trying to engage the big toe joint. And so it does have a naturally high arch. I think it's the principle of what it's trying to do is to lock the hind foot, but then push the pressure onto the forefoot. Okay. And it's difficult when you're doing this for a mass market to find one solution that fits everybody. So are they working for foot types? Yeah, they work for certain foot types for sure. Are they trying to engage the first MPJ? Yes, they are, because they're trying to get it onto the big toe joint. But by applying by being a generic insole, that insole only works for foot types that represent the insole they're giving. So okay. In cycling, you know, the whole goal is to engage the big toe as much as you can. But if that big toe in its best position is off the ground and then you have a wedge laterally, it's going to actually lever you over. So right. That's where it becomes quite complicated in that sense. But it has a position in the market, and I think it's a solution. Is it for everybody? No, because it's a generic insole. But all generic insoles can't really do everything for anyone because it's designed for everyone. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned something interesting there. You said it works for some foot types. How many foot types are there?
Well, there's infinite foot types. I mean, you'll never find 2 feet that are the same, even on the same person. How many foot types? I mean, you have your three classic categories. You have your flat foot, you have your neutral, and you have your high arch. But the reality is I've seen everything from six toes and the highest arches in the world to webbed feet to flat feet that then go into a deviated state. I mean, I've seen everything. So I really couldn't answer that question.
Six toes, really?
Six toes and webbed feet on the same toe, on the same foot. So interesting. I've seen the works. I've seen the works.
A superhero in another life. So, okay. So that's all fascinating. Thanks for sharing that. How much do the shoes impact the fit on a rider or the activation of the power joint? How much do shoes impact the performance?
Oh, look. Shoes have been I would say a passion. It sounds like it's a bit of a passion is probably the wrong word. I've had a lot of interest in footwear for a long time, and that's one of the reasons that led me to making the carbon shoe. But I could hypothetically, or someone could make the world's greatest insole, but if it goes in the shoe that doesn't represent the foot type, it's there's no point you having that insole. It'll have you no effect. You've got to think of the shoe as a second skin. The better that shoe represents that individual's foot, the better the performance will be. So every shoe gets broken down, and every shoe company has a different last, a different width, and a different depth. Now, the last is the physical shape of the shoe. So it's the actual representation of what the foot physically looks like. The depth is the forefoot region we're talking about through here and through the around the regions of the forefoot and the first metatarsal, and then the width. So if you look at, for example, for a strange reason in cycling, there's a lot of companies that have a curved last, so a shoe that bends towards the midline of the body. Okay,
and that's called a curved last. Give me an example of a couple of brands that would have a curved.
Yeah, so Lake is typically based on a curved last. Physique is based on a curved last. Then you have some brands that are based on a semi-curved or a semi-straight last, and that'll be more like your Raffers, your Shimano's, okay. And then you have companies which build it on a straight last. Now, the easiest straight last shoe to look at is a Bont, because it's rectangular. It's got that really dead straight thing. A lot of us can visualize a Bont really easily. But specialized, very straight, and don't have that squared nature to them. And Enduro, for that matter, are also quite straight lasted. Now, if most feet, when your heel rolls in, your forefoot rolls out. Okay, so when your heel pronates, your hind foot pronates, your forefoot abducts. Okay, so when the hind foot rolls in, the forefoot rolls out, you basically have something that represents almost like a bit of a duck foot. Okay, now if you put a duck foot into a shoe that curves towards the midline of your body, then essentially you're putting a square peg into a round hole. You're putting two things that don't represent the foot type. Now, through experience, there are more people which have that sort of deviated foot type. So in theory, market studies should suggest that there should be more shoes that are straight than curved. Now, I don't really understand as to why we have so many curved shoes. Like, for example, all of Physique is curved, all of Lake are curved. Well, there's one shoe in Lake that's probably not so curved, and it's the shoe they have probably for the bunions and so forth. But generally speaking, it's a curved-lasted brand. So that for me is really interesting. So if you've got a lot of like irritations with the fourth, third, fourth, and fifth crushing into the side of the foot, into the side of the shoe. You're not really getting a lot of comfort, and there's a lot of discomfort laterally. A good thing to look at is where your foot's positioned in the shoe. Now, we often...
I want to ask you a question about something you said there. Sorry to interrupt. But would it be safe to say, as a rule of thumb, if your heel was turning in and your forefoot was turning out, that you would tend to do better in a straight last shoe?
100%. Yeah. Okay. So that's where I think the market should be. So the majority of shoes should be, because if the majority of people, from my experience, has this deviated foot, then they feel naturally more comfortable in a straighter shoe. Okay. So when it comes down to fitting a shoe, the first thing I do when someone comes in, I always measure their foot, because particularly in the UK, I don't know why, but you don't get a lot of people measuring the foot. And I know brands differ, but your feet lengthens over time. Now, it doesn't grow like your ears or your nose and all that kind of stuff, but it lengthens. And why does it lengthen? Because your arch drops as you get older. So when it drops, your foot's getting bigger and bigger as your arch drops. If your foot's flat and flat, then it's not going to grow anymore. But it's not going to lengthen. But when it comes down to your foot, most people have some sort of an arch, probably more than they think. And as a response, the foot is almost likely to flatten out and lengthen.
Is that a bad thing?
No, it's natural. I mean, our bodies, you know, I'm 43. I mean, my body's well beyond its peak. So I think it's still not bad, but I think the reality is that, you know, you take... Our bodies are always changing, and they only get weaker. And keep in mind, the foot always finds a path to lose resistance, always. So mechanically speaking, it's quite often to find that your foot's going to get less effective. And when it does, you don't move through your foot, you don't challenge the muscles. When you don't challenge the muscles, they get weaker. When you don't yada yada, you end up getting a flatter foot.
So would there be any reason to do like foot strengthening exercises to maybe stop that lengthening process from happening? Or
anything you do is no, do it. I mean, you can't say no to anything like that, right? Because it's only going to make it stronger, make it more efficient. You know, if we look at if we kind of go on a slightly different kind of tangent, we think about like barefoot shoes are really, the principle of barefoot running is really biomechanically efficient, but we're so used to using shoes with heels. You know, those first Nike Freeze that came out had a heel. And so when you have a shoe with a heel, you naturally land on the heel. So it doesn't teach you to run differently. But when you don't have the kind of knowledge that there's a big soft padding under your heel, like, you know, Vivo Barefoots, then you're not going to use your heel, are you? Because it hurts when you run your heel. But you almost need to have pretty good biomechanics to begin with, to get used to those and to get the benefit like you think you're getting, in my opinion, from those barefoot running shoes. So I think there's a lot of validity in the principle. Whether it's going to work for you, again, it comes down to each individual, but certainly do as much as you can. The biggest thing for me is you're probably going to walk about 10,000 steps a day. So if you're going to do, I'm an average person, so if you're going to be doing 10 calf raises or 20 calf raises a day, is it really going to make a big difference? Over 10,000 steps, probably not, but the more you do, the better. And there are certainly different ways to encourage your foot to walk better. So anything you do is going to help in those situations. And keeping in mind, we take our walking biomechanics and we use those walking everyday biomechanics, and that's what we use in the bike.
So, Mick, on that was actually one of the questions I was looking forward to asking you today, is with all of the craze around, barefoot runners and barefoot shoes right now, how do you see the shape of the cycling shoes in general? And would there be any benefit to having a cycling shoe that was more barefoot shaped?
Barefoot shaped as in like anatomically shaped, or a barefoot shoe that's locked into it?
The wider toe box, less pointy at the end. I don't see anything that on the market. And I'm always wondering, I'm like, would that be better?
Well, I guess you could look at a Bond shoe and think, well, that's kind of got the principle. That's got what's called an anatomical last. So it's got a very square toe box and so forth. The width comes down to, you know, what the brands want to provide. So I think at the end of the day, it kind of comes down to trying to make, I think the principle of barefoot mechanics is pretty hard when you think about putting them onto a bike, because when you're putting them onto a bike, it's all about stopping your movement. And we don't want to kind of have this, like, the whole thing is to stop your foot from moving. So by going barefoot onto it, it's kind of doing the opposite of what we're trying to achieve.
Fascinating. Again, but you've kind of nailed that point home a few times. We're really trying to secure that foot and keep it from moving, especially side to side. So on that point, what are some of the things that we can do to minimize the amount of movement that we get in our cycling shoes?
Well, first thing at first, and we're touching on before, the shoe choice is crucial. You know, I've spoken a bit about it before, particularly with a lot of my clients, but there's a massive difference between an entry-level shoe and a high top-end shoe. There's a huge amount of difference. And the biggest difference is in the flexibility and rigidity of that shoe. But also what you get is when you go up to a higher-end shoe is that you get a better fit. There's less bulk to a shoe. So what can we do? The shoe is crucial to how you fit on how you feel on the bike. So the better that shoe represents your foot, the better you'll perform. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is that anything you put in a shoe, anything, is going to have a positive effect. So skiing and cycling, as I mentioned before, they're from the same biomechanical family, right? So when you go skiing, are you a skier?
Snowboard.
Okay, so that's more walking biomechanics because you're moving through your foot when you're learning.
To my father.
Yeah. Okay, well, your father can relate to this then because when you're basically learning to ski, if you're going to go into a high-end ski boot, like a racing boot, it's so stiff, it's hard to find your edges. But on the other end, if you're a really good skier and you go into an entry-level boot, you're going to have so much flexibility that when you want to turn, you can't. So basically what you do is that when you find the right boot, you then basically either do foam-injected liner plus an insole. Now, the better that insole is, it's all about stopping movement. It's the exact same principle. So the difference is in skiing, you're already going down a hill, but it's about how you engage the inside of your foot to turn. That's how you turn. So it's got a very similar kind of concept when it comes to cycling. The more movement we can stop in that shoe, the better. So if the shoe represents your foot, that's great, okay? If you have something in your shoes, because if you think about the generic insole that comes with a shoe, it's just a really floppy piece that just literally prevents you from filling the base of that insole. But the actual shoe itself, the insole itself doesn't really give you anything. So the kind of goal for us is to try and take away as much of the feeling of gappiness and so forth so that you basically feel like you're connecting with the shoe. So if we're talking about creating a stable base, then the first most important thing to do is get your shoes fitted, properly check the size, look at the width, and take into consideration the actual shape. And you can draw a picture of your foot when you're standing up if you want, just trace around the side of it to get an idea of, is your foot really curved going in? Maybe about 5 to 10% maybe really going in towards the big toe, towards the midline. But most people will be relatively straightish or deviating when their toes are wanting to point away from the midline. And then looking at trying to get some sort of insole. So anything you put in a shoe is going to be better than nothing. The better that something is, the more we can specifically look at taking either a pain away or if the person is or engaging that big toe joint to create more stability and power for that matter.
So talk to me a little bit about the sizing, because I hear a few different opinions when I talk to people about the size of shoe you should wear. You're telling me, you know, we need to minimize the amount of space. Does that mean when I put my foot in my cycling shoe, I should like feel the end of the shoe? How much space should I have in my shoe?
Okay, so I was just with one of the Olympic track teams, and the goal is very simple. We for a trackie, we fit the foot up to wearing the shoe as tight as they can possibly be before they start to lose performance. So they've only got to be in the shoe for 45 minutes max. So basically, if you're wearing a boat, you feel like there's completely way too much room. That's just loss of power because you're just moving around the shoe too much. So for a trackie, you're going to fit the shoe as tight as you can tolerate. Okay. The smaller you go to those guys and those teams, and they want to kind of put the tightest thing in there and the tightest shoe on, and that makes a lot of sense. But when you're doing, when you're working with, you know, EF Pro, and you're working with World Tour athletes, and you're working with people in general, okay, you're working with cyclists that want to be comfortable and are on the road on the weekend, it's their passion, it's the exact same process. You need to have a shoe that represents your foot type first. Then if you have a shoe, you can't have more than half a centimetre of overhang on either side of the shoe. So if you have a look at down and you look at where the shoe physically, where your foot physically sits at the widest point, and then have a look at where the sole finishes underneath that. You can kind of do that with putting your finger like just underneath and just making a reference point. If it's more than half a centimetre on either side, it's probably going to be way too narrow for you and you're going to have an issue because where does the pressure go when you've got so much overhang? And then it's about I usually try and have probably half a size, half a thumb in front of the biggest toe. So remember, it's not always the big toe that's the biggest. It's usually right. The second more so than anything else. But the goal is to feel secure. It's not to feel tight. But keep in mind that every shoe company will have a different depth, a different width. So if we look at Rafa, it's going to be a medium width shoe with a medium depth. If you go into the new version of the Specialized, which is a Torch at the high end, it's going to be like a wider forefoot. Actually, it's quite shallow across the top of the forefoot. And if you then go to like the Bontrager, it's a good example, but it's not particularly relevant now because it's a bit of an old shoe. But Bontrager Triple X from probably 3 or so years ago was incredibly high. It was the highest toe box I'd ever seen. So is that a relevant shoe? Well, there are feet that fit it, but obviously it's got to make sure if your foot's swimming around the shoe, you're not going to wear it. So the shoe does come into – it's incredibly important to choose a shoe that fits you because – if not, you're more likely to have an issue because of the way it fits around your foot and it just was never going to work for your foot type.
Interesting. So you were telling me a little bit at team camp about the importance of torsional stiffness in a cycling shoe. Why do we want torsional stiffness in a shoe?
Well, it kind of comes down to that same principle of when you go to an entry-level shoe versus a top-end shoe. You know, entry-level shoes have a plastic base, typically. It's not a carbon base. Now, as the shoes go up in range, they typically, when you get to the top end shoes, they got more and more carbon. They've probably got different versions of carbon or different ways of laying the carbon, but they get stiffer. And that stiffness is incredibly important because, again, it's about stopping your foot from moving. So any movement we have, we want to try and translate that into the pedal, and that produces power. So if there are shoes that have rotation, then when your foot wants to rotate, the shoe allows it, and then we start to go into that range of potentially losing power or losing the control because your foot isn't controlled within the shoe. And there are a couple of shoes, like new ones on the market, that are super light. And you're like, how do they make it so light? And then you find that it's got a little bit of torsion to it. And, you know, it's not the biggest, it's not the end of the world, but it is interesting because the way they make it so light is because they must have to take away from, well, they don't put as much carbon in it, but when they make a bathtub base that it comes up and around, it's got more torsion, it's got more strength because the carbon goes in different directions. And that's how they kind of make up for it. But if a shoe has flex and has rotation, then we're losing power because it typically allows that foot to flex and rotate. And when it's rotating, we don't put as much power through the pedal.
Fascinating. So based on all your experience, do you have some shoe brands that you find fit people the best?
Well, again, it really comes down to the foot type. I don't like, apart from track, I mean, track riding is a bit different because there's one standout shoe that typically fits, works best in the track. And I do find the Bonds work exceptionally well. They're stiff. They are they're firm shoes. But they don't make laces anymore for some strange reason because all the trackies want to use laces and they don't have laces now for some reason. What? And they've replaced them with the Boas.
What's better about laces?
You can just have great attention. You can just basically have great attention. You can really just, you know, really anchor them down onto your foot. And it's really interesting they don't use them anymore. But outside of track, it really isn't a one shoe fits all policy. It really comes down to what shoe fits your foot best. The good thing is that No, I do think there's a big benefit in going to a top end shoe in cycling. I think in the running market, you get a lot better. There's more value in the running market, I think, when you get, say, an ASICS 2000 versus an ASICS Kayano, for example. They're both very top end shoes. The difference between the ASICS 2000, which is easily the runner's running shoe that's much more popular, is that the Kayano seems to be all the bells and whistles you could possibly have. Whereas the 2000 has got just what you need. It's lighter. It's you don't need all that extra stuff. But when it comes down to the cycling market, so in other words, in the running, it feels like the top end has got the top end shoe and then a bonus. Whereas in cycling, it feels like the top end shoe is significantly better than the one below it. Whereas in the running market, it feels like that could be the one you go for. But in cycling, it really feels like you just that extra 40 pounds to up it to the next level. I think you get a lot more value for your money with cycling. So if you can afford it, I do think there is value in going for those shoes, because we're in these shoes for so much. You know, we might walk with running shoes, of course, but, you know, we're in these shoes for hours when we're on the bike. So if it fits your foot, and it's lighter, it just feels like it fits, and it's a better solution.
I think for most of our listeners, I mean, for me, like, riding my bike's the best part of my day, and it's all about enjoyment. So with shoes, I don't think or look at the price. It's like, I just want the best shoes.
Just accept it, I think,
Yeah. So talk to me a little bit more about your process, Mick, in some of the insoles that you make and some of these shoes that you're making. Why are you making them? Who are you making them for? Why are people deciding to go with this fully custom process? And why is that more beneficial than something generic like a Solstar or a Superfeet?
Well, if we look at, so basically my goal is to find that area in the market that when people want something more than something that you can buy off the shelf, they've got a solution for. So, you know, I've specialized in cycling since 2013, and the benefit of, you know, when I first saw these carbon fiber shoes, I thought, you know what, I'm already putting the bottom half of the shoe essentially with the orthotic. The next thing is just wrapping it around and creating essentially a 360-degree orthotic. That's what the shoe is. It's a full carbon shoe that is encapsulating the foot, but that's a time trial shoe. It's a track shoe. And the reason being is that it's, you know, you're going to be literally stuck in this hard shoe for a long time if you're going to be on the road. And it's not really something you'd want to be wearing for 3 or 4 hours. It probably could be quite comfortable, but, you know, it is your foot in its best position. Well, the basis of the way that I've made the shoes is the shoe incorporates that individual's orthotic. And so all the angles which are in their orthotic goes into this shoe. It's not like you've got one thing and it's completely different from the other. And why is that useful? Is because it's a metal shoe. So being a metal shoe, the foot is very unforgiving. Like once you've made that cast, that's the cast and that's the shape it's going to be. So, but when you put the foot into its best position, what you're actually doing is you're locking the foot in its naturally best position. So the position the foot wants to be in and performs best in. Now, when you're in that position, you get a natural locking. So when the foot is pronated, it's unlocked. Now, if you imagine unlocked as an elastic band, maybe a trampoline. Now, when you're locked, you haven't got a trampoline, you've got a hard surface. Now, we're elastic as humans are, so you'll never get a completely locked surface. But the closer you are to that individual's best biomechanical position means that they're more likely to have their foot naturally locked in that best position. So when your foot's unlocked, it will go and crush into whatever part of the foot or shoe it wants to, and it's a metal shoe. So if you're not in the best position, then usually it doesn't feel particularly comfortable because your foot's naturally crushing into the side of the shoe. So it's pretty crucial to put those same measurements in, or as close as I can physically get from the orthotic and put them into that shoe. So that's why I call it a 360-degree orthotic. And the shoe encapsulates it. So any movement that individual wants to do in a marginal sport, we're trying to produce maximum power or transfer every available watt or whatever into the pedal. That's how we do it, by encapsulating the foot. And we, you know, with Stefan, I was really lucky to be given that opportunity. And he's a an incredibly he's a good athlete to work with. He's a great guy and a really easy person to – he communicates what he needs really well, and we work really well together, and that's worked fantastic. As for the orthotics, well, the orthotics, you know, it's a – if someone comes to me, they come to me because they're in pain or they want to be – they feel unstable, and then some want to be more powerful. Now, I can't produce more power. I can't just give you 10%. It doesn't work that way. It just comes down to what your mechanics are. If you happen to have that rigid plank of wood, it's fantastic. But if not, then it really comes down to individually creating an insole which works best for that individual. So, you know, if you're uncomfortable and you can't cycle and cycling is your passion, that's where I'm useful because, you know, the insole I make for an EF rider, the insole I make for an Olympian, the insole I make for you, they're all exactly the same because in terms of the quality of the material, the design is completely different because based on what you need, but, you know, there's not an Olympian design. It's not like there's a lighter material that goes into it. It's the same one. It's just when you happen to be putting the foot in its best position, you're equally putting the pressure all around the foot. You're putting the foot in its best position. So as a byproduct of putting you in your best position, it usually takes the pain away because pain's a product of an overload somewhere in that foot. So if you take that pressure away, you load it somewhere else and you load it evenly, then what you're doing is you're making that individual not just more comfortable, but as a byproduct, they're also more powerful and more stable because they're engaging the big toe joint when they want to. So it's the same process. It's not like there's an orthotic for a numb forefoot, for example, the hot foot. You know, there's a classic example. It's, you know, we talk about met domes and people look for solutions with met domes all the time. And met domes are the most horrible thing. Do you know what a met dome is? It's that little button.
Yeah.
Little metatarsal button. You can buy those on the internet.
You don't like metatarsal buttons?
Well, if you buy metatarsal buttons off the internet, for example, and then you wear it, it's going to hurt like hell because when your foot is just when you're standing on the ground, the pressure is your natural biomechanical distribution of pressure. A metatarsal button doesn't distribute it. All it does is increase the pressure because you haven't changed how your foot is working. So metatarsal buttons alone never work. And if they do, it's pure luck. And you know, when I get the orthotics made, you know, I've worked with my manufacturer for a lot of years, and you know, when we first started talking about this, I put a metatarsal dome into the insoles, but I do it because I get him to shave 2/3 of it off, and it's like the remnants, it's like the skeletal remnants of the metatarsal dome before there's hardly anything there. And I think it's useful, but a metatarsal dome alone just doesn't really fix anything if you don't change why or how the mechanical loading is happening in the first place. So it just, in my case, it's just bruising your feet and it feels really uncomfortable. So, you know, there's got to be a method, and, you know, there's got to be a reason as to why you do something. And cycling, it's all about piecing together a puzzle. So once you've got, once you understand the biomechanical movements of the foot, it's you piece together that structure like a puzzle. And when you do, you get the results.
So how long does it take for somebody to typically go through your custom insole process?
For me, it takes about 3 weeks. So, and the reason for that is simply because the manufacturer takes them for about 2.5, and then from that it comes back to our clinics. So, you know, it really just kind of depends on how fast you can get them back in and so forth. But when you're looking at things that are made on the spot, like, you know, there's a lot of really good solutions we have, I think, at a generic level and then at a customized level. And then the orthotics are what I do, the orthotics being the prescription. Anything that you can heat up on the spot, you can imagine that when that material cools down, if you put a 20-kilogram bag of rice on it, it would probably collapse, okay? So human bodies aren't 20 kilos either. So you've got to imagine that if something can flex or heat up quite quickly, it can also collapse quite quickly. And if the device can collapse under loading, then your body is telling the orthotic or the insole rather what to do. But rather, if the orthotic is rock hard, now my orthotics are rock hard, okay? The forefoot has padding, but the insole themselves are rock hard. And the reason for that is that I'm asking your foot and telling you this is where your foot needs to be, rather than your body telling your foot what to do. So the goal is, like, soft orthotics tend to feel hard and hard orthotics tend to feel soft because it's a natural capturing of that individual's foot. But if I was to wear your orthotic, it'd be horrible because it's not my arch. So but soft orthotics, they tend to bunch up into an area until you feel one particular point, and that's the point you feel. So there are different ways of looking at it. So I think the insoles that you can buy as a customizable option in the shops, in the cycling shops, and in also the ski villages, for example, they're good. They're good solutions, and they're good immediate solutions, because anything you put into that shoe is going to have a positive effect. But if you want something specific, if something does everything, it can't really do anything specifically. So it's not going to be probably what you want in terms of, you know, producing power. But if it makes you more stable than what you were, 100%. And it's better to have something in there rather than nothing. That goes for skiing and cycling.
Amazing. So much information in today's episode. Mick, how can people get in touch with you if they want to reach out and get some insoles?
Well, I mean, Instagram's probably the way we do it these days, isn't it?
Instagram, so, yeah, email.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's Mick. It's mick.fit/cycle is the Instagram tag. And it's mick@mick.fit that I have taken out the C in mick.fit, and that makes it more complicated, but hey, we can figure that out as we go along.
Awesome. Well, Mick, you've convinced me to go out and get a Straight Last shoe and also reserve my own time slot with you in the next training camp.
The next one.
I need to get a custom set of these insoles for sure. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. That was awesome. There's tons of information in there. I highly recommend you guys get in touch with Mick if you're interested in getting some custom insoles. I know, like I said, I will be. So, Mick, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. That was awesome.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me, man.